Taking Stock on Newstalk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
This is Newstalk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk with me, Vincent Wall. This is where we take a wider view of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Joe Miller, who's based in Frankfurt with the Financial Times. Joe, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's been another gloomy week for the key motor manufacturing sector in Germany, Joe. A key report basically outlining the scale of the challenges and potential employment impact by the switch to electric engines. More arrests in Volkswagen related to the Dieselgate scandal. And I suppose where we might start, just the impact of the slowdown in the motor industry generally on the wider German economy last year. The German economy grew by its slowest amount in 6 years.
Yeah, so the German economy has been slow and steady for quite a few years. It hasn't been growing explosively, but it has been growing slowly off the back of really the rise of China. And this is where the car industry really comes in, because we had Dieselgate and 5 years before that, or a few years before that rather, the financial crisis. And what really helped German car makers and the German car industry out of that was all of this growth in Asia and in particularly China. That's begun to slow down and that's really begun to have an impact on the whole German economy. The car industry itself isn't such a major part of the German economy when you look at the pure numbers, the pure percentages. In fact, manufacturing is about the same percentage of the German economy as it is for other developed economies like the UK. But it supports a lot of jobs. And because it supports a lot of jobs, even small fluctuations in the amount of cars produced and the health of these big auto suppliers can have a big impact on the German economy, because something like 3 million people depend on this industry in terms of their jobs. And if they have less to spend, it really begins to impact the broader German economy very, very, very quickly. And that's why politicians in Berlin watch the industry so closely. That's why this Wednesday, for example, Angela Merkel met with all of the auto chiefs. She does so periodically. It's because it's an incredibly sensitive indicator of how well the German economy as a whole will do in the next few months. And it's not inconceivable that we will see some form of state aid or help being given to these automakers if things begin to worsen, if more jobs go. We've seen about 50,000 jobs go so far last year. If 2020 continues at the same pace, we might start seeing a lot more help from not just Berlin, but Brussels, really.
And the situation last year compounded not just by the slowdown in the Chinese economy generally, the trade tensions between China and the United States, which I suppose spread worldwide, but also much more stringent environmental emission standards for German car manufacturers. And a major report out this week, the National Platform on Future Mobility, shows the scale of the challenge facing Germany's industry as electrification develops.
Yes, that's right. I mean, automakers in Germany are really facing the perfect storm. You know, as we said, we've got a slowdown in China. You mentioned the trade war, which may even worsen in the coming year. But the big, big challenge are these new EU-wide emissions regulations. And essentially, what they mandate is that fleet-wide, every car maker's fleet has to have an average of 95 grams of CO2 per kilometre in terms of emissions. Now, roughly speaking, it changes, it fluctuates based on different car makers. The German car makers are around 110, perhaps a little bit higher, a little bit lower. So they've got a long way to go before they can get to those targets. If they don't hit those targets in the next couple of years, they're looking at billions of euros in fines from Brussels, which of course they can't afford, but worse, it would compound the reputational damage that they accumulated through Dieselgate. And so what we've seen is Volkswagen, the biggest, the world's largest car maker, taking the lead and investing heavily in electric vehicles so as to bring the average emissions of their fleet down. And this is the year in which they have to sell hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles in order to avoid those fines, or at least begin to sell them. And as they do so, as they ramp up electric production, not just this year, but in the coming years, the core value chain that has buoyed the German car makers for more than a century is being eroded, because really what they can do very well and where their expertise lies is in combustion engines, which are very, very complex instruments that have about 200 moving parts. And now they're moving to electric vehicles, which are far, far simpler product. They have something like a couple of dozen moving parts. And so we're already beginning to see that the big suppliers like Continental, like Bosch, are beginning to hemorrhage jobs. And the automakers, it's only really a matter of time before they too have to let a lot of people go. Now, this report that came out earlier this week, it must be said that's a worst case scenario. They're saying 410,000 jobs might go in the German economy as a whole because of this change to electrification over the next 10 years. But that assumes that the German car companies and German industry doesn't get a handle on some of these innovations, on particularly battery cell competency. And you can write off German industry at your peril. It may be true that China and South Korea and others will grab the vast majority of the value of electric vehicles by developing batteries. It could also be that German industry gets their act together in the next few years, makes some very wise acquisitions, and some of that expertise comes back to Germany. So it's important to stress that is a worst case scenario, but it's these warnings are coming thick and fast these days, and they're really beginning to worry not just the car makers, but I say, you know, policymakers and politicians as well.
And I presume that need for innovation and a transformative shift to batteries and all the components that are required for electric vehicles, the investment required there, the training required there, was probably a key focus of discussion with Angela Merkel during the week.
Oh, absolutely. And the car makers are crying out for help with the cost of this investment. Volkswagen's investment into electric vehicles is the biggest single corporate investment package in the world right now. It's managing to do so because it has quite a diversified portfolio. It has many, many brands around the world, Audi and Porsche, which bring in a lot of revenue, which they can then put into this investment package. Other car makers like Daimler and BMW, they rely on the revenue from their SUVs and premium vehicles, which are quite polluting, heavily polluting vehicles, to fund this investment. And what they're saying to policymakers and to Brussels is, we can't pursue a two-engine strategy. We can't, on the one hand, continue to make the vehicles that bring us the most money and continue to run these production lines while essentially creating an entirely new industry at the same time. We do not have the funds to be able to do that. And certainly Daimler's case, they're in dire straits as a company in terms of trying to find that money and trying to pay for that investment. And they've announced severe job losses over the next few years. At 20,000 or so around the world. And so we're looking at a real crunch point now where there's a strong possibility that if electric vehicles don't get sold fast enough, and if it becomes clear that car makers need to invest more heavily and more quickly, then the begging bowl will be brought out and they will be going to Berlin and Brussels and saying, this is an existential crisis. You either help us out here or we will be forced out of existence, and with us millions of jobs around Europe.
You mentioned Volkswagen there as one of the leaders in the sector, not just in Germany, but globally, Joe. A mixed week for Volkswagen, because actually, in terms of production, they achieved record vehicle production last year, nearly 11 million vehicles, sales up 6% in Germany, although not as good on the export front. But on the negative side, six more executives, unnamed executives, mind you, charged as a result of the ongoing Dieselgate scandal.
Yes, absolutely. And the truth is that the electrification crisis or challenge goes hand in hand with the ongoing Dieselgate fallout. One of the reasons that Volkswagen has really come to the fore in this challenge to move to electrification is it really desperately wants to move past Dieselgate. It wants to rebrand itself as the future of what they call mobility here, and it wants to be seen to be the leader in the modern transportation economy. Meanwhile, Dieselgate continues to grab the headlines here. There are multiple cases, so many cases, in fact, that I have to keep a list on my desk of the various different lawsuits facing various different manufacturers here in Germany. But there doesn't seem to be any chance of any of these being resolved in any sort of near future. And this particular case with these managers isn't actually against Volkswagen itself. It's against executives who may or may not still be there. The prosecutors won't tell us. Plus, we have former CEO Martin Winterkorn, who is also facing similar charges that were brought a few months ago. And at some point, this will all be tried, probably in an open court. And so Volkswagen is looking at years, probably, of Dieselgate still being in the headlines and of negative headlines continuing to dominate. And so it really compounds the pressure on them as a company to try and move beyond Dieselgate as much as possible and to be known for something else. And what they want to be known as is the company that took on Tesla and won, and the German company that managed to reform itself into this green pioneer. And certainly its plans are the most ambitious in the world. Whether it manages to do that really depends on whether people buy that, whether customers buy that proposition, quite literally, whether they're willing to let go of their petrol and diesel vehicles and trust a new, brand new technology from Volkswagen, from a company that has had a terrible track record in the last decade, and say, right, I'm going to start buying these vehicles, this ID3, for example, that's coming out later this year, and I'm going to transform the way I drive. And that's the big bet that Volkswagen has made. This year, we'll begin to see whether it pays off.
Turning to the challenges faced by the wider German economy through the 2020s, Joe, Angela Merkel, Chancellor, is in her last lap. She'll step down in 2021, but she gave a major interview to your own newspaper this week, the Financial Times, and you know, she faced up to the fairly systemic challenges facing not just the German economy, but the European economy with Brexit, with the turning away of the United States, and in fact, the aggression of the United States towards Europe and indeed Germany under the Trump administration. We talked about the need for innovation and perhaps significant investment in the motor industry, but do you think that she or her successors will loosen the purse strings to invest strategically in the German economy, in environmental change, in building up industrial champions, in developing perhaps German or European competitors for the tech champions in the United States?
Yes, I think they probably will. I was here in Germany last 2 or 3 years ago, covering actually the last elections in 2017. And there's a marked change in tone among senior politicians. As you know, Germany has long pursued a policy under the Grand Coalition between the CDU and the SPD of keeping a balanced budget and of not borrowing to spend. It's a grand simplification, because that's more or less the strategy. And in the last few months, we've really seen some of the most conservative voices, some of the most fiscally conservative voices come out and say that if Germany doesn't start spending on infrastructure, if it doesn't start spending on innovation, if it doesn't start spending on education, it will fall behind very, very quickly. And Brexit really does compound that. And I think that's, if you read between the lines of Angela Merkel's interview with the FT, that's really what she's getting at, is that if there is this major economy on Germany's doorstep, which is unbound from the shackles of EU regulation and is able to invest more quickly and create national champions, as you say, without worrying too much about competition regulation, etc., that it may move much, much faster than Germany. And I think whoever succeeds Angela Merkel, we will almost certainly see a shift in tone. And I think it's also driven by people who live and work in Germany, who, on the one hand, you know, Germany is a very fiscally conservative place. People do not like the idea of their government spending more than it brings in. On the other hand, basic infrastructure is lacking here. 4G, for example, is incredibly patchy. It's very difficult to get decent broadband connections. Many businesses are hurt by this. Some of the schools in the richest cities in Germany, in Munich, in Frankfurt, are woefully underdeveloped and really rather shocking if you go into them. You know, you would assume that a German public school would be fairly well provided for. But that's not the case in Germany. And you drive around even some of the richest states like Hessen, which I'm in, and you will see crumbling bridges and infrastructure that really needs some care and attention. And so the mood is slowly changing. And then there's also the challenge faced by industry. For example, like the software industry in Germany, which does exist and used to be a leader in Europe and the world and is now falling behind American rivals. In fact, Apple is about to become, is about to get a market value that's higher than the entire DAX 30, than 30's top publicly listed companies. And so we're at a point where I think all German leaders, or at least the most mainstream German leaders, acknowledge that something has to be done to turbocharge innovation in Germany, and that's probably going to come in the form of public spending in the next few years.
Be interesting to see if we face another German economic miracle over the decade ahead, but we'll leave it there. That's Joe Miller, the Frankfurt correspondent with Financial Times. Joe, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. PwC.ie.
We're joined now by Ger Gilroy from Off the Ball. Ger, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Vincent.
Now, a lot of focus, a lot of controversy, including on all your own Off the Ball platforms during the week about the large-scale sport infrastructure grants that were dispensed during the week provisionally, including the 20 million euro that's going to the Sports Ground Stadium in Galway. It just makes us think that we might just look at where taxpayers' money is going in terms of support for sport, the criteria involved in making these decisions, the allocation between publicly and privately owned facilities, and indeed the whole question of should we be pumping more into participation generally, getting every Joe and Mary out on the street, out on, running around, or into performance, or into bricks and mortar?
Okay, they're all brilliant questions, right? And I think it kind of strikes to the core of what the conversation this week was and wasn't. Essentially, the government has access to a big pot of cash for infrastructural projects, which they dole out. And some of that money's gone to the RDS, some of that money has gone to the sports grounds in Galway, which technically is owned, I think, by Bord na Gan, the greyhound industry, which is another big thing that we should actually talk about in the middle of all this as well. My question is, should we be spending money on sports facilities? Should we be spending taxpayers' money on sports facilities when sports organisations can actually fund themselves? So this week, for example, we see speculation about the IRFU getting a windfall from the private capital firm that we've spoken about on the show before,
CVC.
They're taking a stake in the Pro 14 League because they're going to control that. They're going to control the Premiership. They're going to control World Rugby, essentially the Six Nations as well. And the IRFU are going to get a windfall from that. So they could, if they wanted to, afford to give money to the redevelopment of the RDS and money to the redevelopment of the sports grounds. But they don't own the RDS and the sports grounds. So they're it seems to me, looking from the outside, and they've never confirmed this, is why would they spend money redeveloping facilities that they don't own, which their teams use? But why would the government spend money redeveloping, spend taxpayers' money, our money, redeveloping facilities which are going to be used for sports organisations which we don't own?
And this is a long-standing process, because obviously the focus on the sports ground in Galway this week, not just coming from that large-scale sport infrastructure fund, but another 10 million euro from the 2040 National Development Fund. But like 200 million euro of state funds went into the Aviva Stadium. When Páirc Chaoimh went overboard on its budget, 30 million euro of state funds there. And the state really has no comeback as to how those stadia are used, even if it's a good investment in the first place. They have no comeback as to how those stadia are used, whether they can get access to the facility for wider participation like the community games or whatever.
Exactly. A couple of years ago, a move was made to try and prevent funding being given to any stadium or project that would be single sport use. And what happened after that was sports organisations, the big ones, partnered with small ones. So you could get the Tiddlywinks Association partnering with one of the big three sports, and it's like, oh, this is multi-sport, so we're going to have Tiddlywinks in the hall. Sure, it's totally fine, right? Which wasn't the point. The government needs to say, if you have a stadium, you have to share it with soccer and rugby and GAA. And we're going to fund that because we're actually all going to see the benefits of it. And there's going to be a proper use of resources. We have two big stadiums in Dublin city centre that, from a business perspective, both are incredibly well run. So they're full every day of the year with conferences. But the pitches and the stadiums themselves frequently are lying empty when the other one would actually be the right size for it. So when Ireland play England in rugby, you'd fill Croke Park if you wanted to. The Aviva is bursting at the seams because you could oversell the tickets. When the Dublin footballers are playing anybody in Leinster, you might fill the Aviva, maybe, at 45,000, 50,000. There's no way you're filling Croke Park if they're playing Westmeath.
The only thing is that the actual pitch itself isn't sufficiently big to hold Gaelic games, but that perhaps should have gone into the planning for the stadium.
Initially, when they were asking for the funding, when the plans were being drawn up, they were like, oh, we make the pitch big enough so we can share it. Now that's all gone by the wayside. So that horse might have bolted, but why are we allowing all the rest of the horses to keep going out the doors in Porkeycui, for example, or in the sports grounds or in the RDS? Why do we continue to make the mistakes of the past? And interestingly, the Chief Whip was on our show during the week, and he was like, well, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it was Cork or Dublin. The whole point is that we made that mistake already and they got their money for that mistake. We want our money for our mistake right now.
And whatever about a city the size of Dublin, where, as you say, both stadia are underused at times, but at least the scale of the population here and the international dimension will see them used to some degree. You look at a city like Limerick, you know, where
Thomond
Park and the Gaelic grounds are a mile away from each other, different codes. The sports grounds now and Pearse Stadium in Salthill, a mile away from each other. We're exacerbating this investment in infrastructure in different codes in small cities, whereas where the European model is, there's a municipal stadium and every sport uses it.
Those are now competing businesses. Like if you want to have a conference centre, there's now two separate conference centres competing with each other. The two stadiums have to compete from this tiny pool, as opposed to pooling their resources and working together and having an amazing facility that's used all year round. The GAA and rugby seasons work perfectly together. They actually dovetail beautifully. It's like you couldn't design a sports culture better that is busy all year round if there was just one perfect facility that worked for everybody. Porkeycui is going to end up being one of those projects that in years to come we're like, not in a great situation, access isn't great, stadium is brilliant. How often is it full? Is it ever full? Like almost never. What's the point of that?
That's even within the politics of the GAA. Cork is one of the largest bodies within the GAA. Cork politics, as we know, is different. So they had to have a jewel in the crown, and we're all helping to pay for it. It's not just state money, taxpayer money, going into fund competing stadia and businesses within the same small city. It's also within the same sporting code, amateur sporting code. We're both Kildare men. I'm personally glad to see that St. Conlon's Park in Newbridge, the county grounds, is getting €5 million from this to redevelop the stand. But my business brain, my logical brain says, why give €5 million to St. Conlon's and €6 million to the stadium, the proposed new stadium in Navan? They're only 30 or 40 miles apart. Dublin, which is only another 40 miles aside, needs a 40,000-seater stadium. You know, forget the GAA boundaries and build one.
Build one somewhere on the boundaries, build it in Maynooth, build it at City West. You know, there's loads of great sites. Apparently there is a greenfield site out at City West that Dublin GAA are interested in. And so then you'll have Navan, something there, and St. Conleth Park. And look, I'm from Athy, you're from Castledermot, about as far down south in the county as you can get. I wouldn't really mind going to City West for a home game if it was a home game and we were getting all the tickets and the ticket distribution was managed. If I felt like we have this incredible facility and there's training facilities, I mean, the hockey field already exists, so they probably don't need, but there's access to stuff and it's shared. it's not about building stuff in Dublin to give it to Dublin. It's about what's the best plan for how our population is going to evolve over the next 40 years. What is the long-term planning here? And to me, what's happening is the politicians are, they claim that all of this is independent and that they have no influence over it. And maybe that's the case, but you're going to have to colour me sceptical given that our track record in our history all the way back to the very first time that this fund was introduced and all of the way that funding has been introduced ends up forcing people to go, well, I want my share. We had John Considine, the director of economics at UCC, on the show during the week.
He's former Cork hurler.
Exactly, and former Cork manager. But his head is an economics head, and he's tracked this over the years. The money follows the ministers. And it's inevitable if you set up a system that everybody wants their share. So you need to remove the ability for anybody to have their share and go, what did the math say about the population on a county-by-county basis? You're going to get, to your needs, you're going to get this. But all of the resources have to be shared. Final point from how the funding should work. This funding for, Avan Yates made the point on the show to Joe during the week that this funding is not, all funding isn't equal. The stuff under 100 grand, essentially that's a slush fund for politicians. But this is large scale infrastructural. It's mostly transparent. But my question is, why are we spending large scale infrastructural money on facilities when we have loads of facilities? We have more than enough facilities. The ESRI did a survey back in the mid noughties and they were like, you've got plenty of facilities when it comes to sport in this country. You don't have enough coaches, you don't have enough administrators, you don't actually have the architecture required to make sure that kids are getting access to top quality coaching, parents feel comfortable that the kids are there, and then they're going to continue to grow through that sport and come out the other side as adults who are participating in a community event. We took the notion that there needs to be something that you can cut the ribbon on and you can have the big building and you can show people that we built this, but then you go there and it's empty. That is, we've got this completely the wrong way around. We need to invest in people and the people will make do. Like, okay, you need proper changing rooms and you need pitches that are flat and you need grass growing on those pitches. But after that, people are creative and intelligent and they're passionate about this sport and they want to do it, but they need help in the administration and the coaching side of it.
And yet perhaps we get the sport, the public sport investment process that we, the voters, deserve, because, you know, voters in a particular constituency where they have a minister who can influence how these things allegedly will punish that person unless he or she gets a higher share for their county or their constituency than might otherwise have been the case. And we all expect some level of high performance from our athletes when it comes to international dimensions, the Olympics, international athletics events and whatever. So we do need a certain level of high performance facilities.
I would agree that we do need some level of high performance facilities, absolutely. And that's fair enough. But the long-term, long-form argument here is that if you've got more people engaged in the sports longer, you're actually going to improve your high performance by sheer dint of numbers anyway. We've invested a lot of money in our high performance stuff right around the country, and high performance has actually been revolutionized in the last two decades by, you know, you go back to Gary Keegan and the boxers and what they've done, and he's had a massive, his fingerprints are all over the quantum leap that we've made in terms of high performance. We're getting most of that side right, but to go back to the point about the politicians, and we get the politicians we deserve, 100%, we are all culpable in this. So I'm asking the question again. A stadium automatically brings economic benefit to a place. How? Let's prove that. Let's get that now.
Let's bring some science to this.
Let's get it modelled out properly today, as opposed to 40 years ago, you built Croke Park, it was great for Dublin One. I mean, it probably hasn't been that great specifically for Dublin One. How good has the Aviva been for a few of those pubs four or five times around the year? There's more to this than those figures. It's the bed nights and all that kind of stuff. Well, actually, they'd be coming anyway. They would be coming anyway. The tourists come anyway. But the politicians need to be completely divorced from this. And it can't just be Sport Ireland who end up working for the minister as well who are doing it, because we've seen that that process is also, you can also interfere in that process. It needs to be on a strict per capita basis, and the criteria needs to be how many people are going to use this. And if you hit a certain number, let's go for it. Let's build those facilities and let's put public money into that. I'm not against putting public money into sports facilities. I'm against public money being put into sports facilities where the sports bodies are sitting on massive reserves of cash and can completely afford to do it themselves. But they're smart enough to know that the politics are going to result in somebody else picking up the tab for them.
leaving the politics aside briefly and the philosophy, if we have one at all, as to where the money should go and how much should go where, the whole question of participation, football, soccer, is the biggest participative sport in the country. It only got one grant out of this 77 million, I think about 2 million euro for the Munster Centre of Excellence in Glanmire. How much of that is down just to a lack of trust in the FAI at the moment? How much of it is down, as politicians seem to suggest, some sports bodies, some organisations just don't fill in the forms as well as others?
Well, I think that part of it is, and I wonder what the attitude of the politicians is when they're making that declaration. Are they like, well, it's your own fault? Because I've seen a politician go, geez, I hate that soccer crowd. Look at them changing in their containers. I'm like, well, you should fix that. That's your job as a politician is to fix that. I think it absolutely is down to how you fill in the form. So if you are a hockey school, if you are a rugby school, you've got reams and reams of people who are qualified who have helped set the exams. And you know that if you help set the exams, you know what the correct answers are. I don't know if the soccer clubs in Athy and Castledermot, and Castlevilla got some money recently from sports grant, but
yeah,
it took, we had them on and it took them, they had to jump through a lot of hoops and they ended up getting a tiny amount. So I do think that the system is automatically skewed in favour of those classes that know what the correct answers are. And look, we know exactly what I'm talking about here. The lawyers, the architects, you know, they're the members of the clubs who are getting the money. The GAA are actually very good at it as well. And in fairness, there's a project on in UCC where you can apply for some help in filling out the forms, and that's, I think, beginning to come to the fore. So there are legal departments who are actually helping sports clubs to win this. But look at the lengths we have to go to. Like, we should be going to these clubs saying, you've got no facilities, lads, what can we do? I see that you've got 400 kids every week coming here. There's nowhere for them to change. Maybe we could help you out. Instead, it's like, could we get some nets? How do we go about that? Can you fill in the forms? No.
With an election underway, can you see things changing anytime soon?
I think that it's too easy. All the way back to Charlie Haughey winning the Tour de France. All the way back. Everybody wants to be associated with the glory. And if that's super international glory, or if that is at your local GAA pitch going, that's a nice new stand, or look at those floodlights that I got for you. Sport's very important. You know, it's a really great participation thing, but actually, give me the votes. Give me that part of it's never going to change. Unless we as a people decide and keep talking about this, give it back to us. These are our games. These are the games that we love, that we have stood on sidelines freezing, or that we've participated in whenever we could. Give it back to us. And maybe we do need to start a movement here, Vincent.
Well, listen, thanks for sparking the debate again, Ger. We leave it there. That's Ger Gilroy from Off the Ball. Ger, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a million.
Well, that's it from this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings at newstalk.com and on the Newstalk app. So for now, from Taking Stock, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Think change. Think PwC. Think beyond. pwc.ie